This program is about unsolved mysteries. Whenever possible, the actual family members and police officials have participated in recreating the events. What you are about to see is not a news broadcast.
The Ouija board. To some, an entertaining parlor game. To others, a strange and wondrous instrument able to bridge the gap between the living and the dead. It may sound unbelievable, but tonight we'll bring you the remarkable case of Pearl Curran, who claimed that through the Ouija board, she became the earthly conduit for a literary spirit named Patience Worth. September 1993, a motel manager reports an abandoned car in his parking lot. The vehicle belongs to Justin Bergwinkle, an Army enlisted man who had apparently gone AWOL 3 months earlier. To Justin's parents, the discovery was the latest twist in a dark scenario that may have led to their son's death. At first, it seemed like a routine drug case, a few grams of cocaine smuggled across state lines in a box of clothes. But then a fistful of suspicious $100 bills put investigators on the trail of a king's ransom and bogus C-notes. Now authorities need your help to capture one of the most prolific counterfeiters in history. Join me. Perhaps you hold the key. Perhaps you may be able to help solve a mystery. The Ouija board, modern face of a timeless instrument, revered for nearly 3,000 years as a method to predict the future and contact the spirits of the dead. For all its alleged powers, the Ouija is disarmingly simple, nothing more than a flat piece of wood adorned with letters and numbers. Hands resting lightly on a pointer, one of the participants asks a question. Supposedly, the indicator will move of its own accord and spell out an answer. The Ouija board first became popular in the United States during the 1890s when it was marketed as a provocative parlor game. A century later, the board is still a bestseller and still handing out answers that push the limits of scientific explanation. Consider the case of Gaynell Rawley of Dunkirk, New York. Some years ago, Gaynell was musing about a trip to Scotland when she playfully asked the Ouija board for more details. Gaynell's husband looked on from the kitchen.
I wonder who I'm going to go to Scotland with, who I'm going to cross the border with.
I didn't really ask the Ouija board that. I just said it, kind of sarcastic. You know, who's going to be with me when I go across the border?
That's what I'd like to know.
Whoa.
Gaynell says that without hesitation, the pointer began to move.
And?
Soon the baffling answer was complete. J.D. McDonald. The Rawleys did not know a single person with that last name.
J.D. McDonald.
Fun though, huh?
6 months later, the Rawleys were steaming across England headed for the Scottish border. They got the shock of a lifetime when they were approached by a fellow passenger, a stranger.
Hi, I'm J.D. McDonald. I'm from Sydney, Australia.
Daniel. The minute she said it, I remembered the Ouija board saying it.
I'm Gay Rawley.
It stunned me so that I started to kind of laugh, and I must have acted a little strange because the woman kind of pulled back, startled.
Oh, New York. Oh, cool.
J.D. McDonald. The Rawleys continue to wonder if their startling encounter was simply a coincidence or proof positive that the Ouija board has supernatural powers. The Raleigh's experience, though hardly earth-shaking, is nonetheless a fitting introduction to the most remarkable Ouija episode of all time. Beginning in 1913 and continuing for several years, the lively spirit of a 17th century Englishwoman named Patience Worth reportedly spoke through the board from beyond the grave. And by all accounts, Patience wasn't content with a simple hello. She composed plays, novels, and countless poems, an astounding body of work filling some 30 volumes that has yet to be fully explained. The unlikely recipient of these unworldly contacts was Pearl Curran, wife of a prosperous St. Louis, Missouri businessman. Until Patience came calling, Pearl apparently had no interest in the occult, no creative activities beyond a love of music.
Pearl Curran had a very close friend named Emily Grant Hutchings, who was a very active freelance writer. Mrs. Hutchings became interested in spiritualism and the Ouija board. She persuaded Pearl Curran to take part in some experiments with the Ouija board around 1912. As far as we know, Mrs. Curran was very reluctant.
Emily, I think you've gotten carried away with this Ouija board. I really do.
I haven't. It's like ether, the gases.
Once a week for nearly a year, Pearl gamely played along to humor her friend. However, the Ouija produced little more than gibberish.
You've been reading.
On many evenings, Pearl's mother joined the session, notebook in hand, just in case.
M-A-N.
On July 8th, 1913, the women had barely taken their places when the pointer suddenly began whipping across the board, selecting letters in a dizzying rush.
I-L-I.
To the amazement of all present, the letters formed words, the words a sentence.
Many moons ago I lived, again I come. Patience Worth, my name. Oh, it's a message. Patience, oh, that's a Quaker name.
It was a modest beginning, but soon the women truly began to believe that the spirit of Patience Worth, a young Englishwoman dead some 250 years, was reaching out through the Ouija board.
See?
Over the next few months, Patience began to dictate literary works in an archaic style, sprinkled with words like thee and thou.
O-N-F.
Well, the language of Patience Worth was one of the many, many baffling things in this case. It apparently was an amalgam or a melange of words from many different times in English history, and Patience was often asked, why do you speak in such difficult language? And her answer, in effect, was, I do this because if I spoke in a simpler way, you would assume it was Mrs. Curran speaking, and it's not Mrs. Curran speaking, it's Patience Worth speaking.
And Patience was speaking volumes. By 1915, when Pearl's husband John assumed the job of transcribing the sessions, Patience was dictating for hours on end, producing from 500 to 3,000 words at a sitting.
John. Oh, Mr. Reedy, I'm so glad.
Friends and curiosity seekers flocked to St. Louis to witness the astounding creation of poems, plays,
Mr. Reedy,
and novels.
My wife, Pearl.
How do you do?
One of those who came to see the spectacle for himself was William M. Reedy, publisher of a respected literary journal.
You know, I don't believe in this sort of thing.
It is rather amazing.
This is the Ouija board.
Mm-hmm. Patience, would you like to greet Mr. Reedy? A.
Patience replied with characteristic irreverence, roughly translated, hello, Mr. Fat and Wide.
Fat or wide?
She doesn't mean anything. She just does nonsense sometimes.
She certainly does.
Mr. Reedy, how would you like to join in and ask Patience a question yourself?
Do you suppose Patience would continue her work on the novel if I have my hands on?
Why don't we see?
Well.
By the end of the session, William Reedy was enchanted.
Yes.
His enthusiastic articles helped propel the case to international prominence.
Reedy never was willing to admit that Patience Worth was indeed a spirit. He never would go that far. But what he did proclaim, and he proclaimed it again and again in his journal, was the literary merit of the writings of Patience Worth. In fact, he said that these were extremely, extremely remarkable writings, almost unparalleled in literary history.
The praise continued when Patience completed a full-length novel, The Sorry Tale. Despite its mysterious origins, the book was snapped up by publishing giant Henry Holt & Company.
The Sorry Tale was a novel about Palestine at the time of Jesus. A leading historian in St. Louis reviewed The Sorry Tale, and he said, unquestionably, this is the greatest book about Jesus written since the Gospels. Now, for a distinguished historian to write something of this kind was almost unheard of, because he was putting his career on the line by taking this position about the writings of someone purporting to be a spirit.
Patience Worth was a spirit from the 16th century as far as pure Pearl Curran is concerned. She was
Stoker Hunt, author of Ouija, The Most Dangerous Game.
Probably the best documented case of Ouija work in the Western world. She did. She produced masterpiece after masterpiece, hailed at the time as masterpieces. Her poetry was published in very sophisticated books, magazines of poetry.
Indeed, the New York Times gave The Sorry Tale a rousing review, saying it was written with, quote, the precision and the accuracy of a master hand. However, the acclaim was not universal. Some skeptics accused Pearl Curran of fraud. They charged that she would memorize stories all day, then at the sessions, pass off the information as coming from Patience Worth.
The investigators, and there were a number of them, who really looked into the case very carefully, found that there was just no truth in these stories. Everybody agreed that Pearl Curran lived the average, typical life of a housewife during the day. She would clean her house. She would go grocery shopping. She was not poring over books all day.
A different theory was advanced by the scientific community. Perhaps Patience Worth and her writings were creations of Pearl Curran's subconscious mind.
Pearl Curran came from working-class parents. Her father was a railroad man. She quit school at the age of 13, and apparently neither before nor after that ever evinced any particular interest in reading or literature or anything of that kind. All of a sudden, this provincial St. Louis housewife had a separate personality that was capable of writing works that the New York Times labeled the works of a genius. I just don't see how science can so readily explain this phenomenon away.
The books and poems, incredible as they seemed, were overshadowed by yet another facet of this astonishing case. The Currans, childless after 9 years of marriage, finally decided to adopt at the persistent urging of none other than Patience Worth. In August of 1916, Pearl and John made arrangements with a widow who was unable to care for the baby she was expecting, a baby Patience predicted would be a girl. For many, the episode would provide convincing evidence that supernatural powers were at work.
One evening, Patience was busily dictating when, precisely at 8 p.m., she suddenly stopped and she said in her own words, "This is enough. How can I go on weaving," which is what she called her writing, "when something of this importance is happening?" And she refused to continue.
"John, I'm suddenly feeling very faint."
"Come, Pearl, dear. Let me take you upstairs with you."
Later that evening, the Currans received electrifying news. The child they planned to adopt was born at 8 p.m., born at precisely the moment Patience had interrupted her Ouija dictation. Just as Patience had foretold, the infant turned out to be a girl. It was the first of several uncanny coincidences noted by the Currans.
They further found, after visiting the child, that the baby had red hair and brown eyes, the exact coloration that Patience Worth often had claimed for herself. They also found out that the mother of the child had ancestry that was English-Scotch, and this was the very same ancestry that Patience Worth had claimed for herself.
"We're going to call her Patience. Patience Worth Curran."
For most spirits, this would have been accomplishment enough. However, Patience Worth continued to dictate through the Ouija board, and a second novel entitled Hope Trueblood hit the stores in 1918. The communication between Pearl and Patience continued unabated for another 19 years. Pearl's husband, John, transcribed the sessions until his death in 1922. In 1930, at the urging of a close friend, Pearl moved from St. Louis to Los Angeles. In November of 1937, the legacy of Patience Worth drew to a close with a disquieting prediction.
Patience has shown me the end of the road. So it's time for you to carry on as best you can. But I'm a bit tired, and I think I'm going to go in for it.
Pearl Curran was apparently healthy when she uttered those words. Inexplicably, she fell ill within 2 weeks. Within another week, she was dead. The voice of Patience Worth had been stilled. Over the course of 24 years, Patience Worth dictated some 4 million words. Her poetry appeared in respected journals. Her novels basked in critical acclaim. But was Patience Worth really a ghost who communicated through Pearl Curran? Perhaps the best answer came from Patience herself. After relentless questioning by a skeptic, Patience shot back a challenge, essentially. If you're so sure this is a trick, let's see you do it. Next, join the hunt for a master counterfeiter who printed up millions in bogus bills. Day in and day out, it is a never-ending battle along thousands of miles of border at dozens of checkpoints. Customs agents face long odds trying to choke off the stream of drugs flooding the United States from Mexico. But every now and then, officials get an unexpected break. In January of 1995, an alert shipping clerk in the border town of Brownsville, Texas, tipped off authorities to suspected narcotics activity. Investigators jumped on the lead. They never dreamed that their routine drug case would take a surprising twist and blow the cover of a master counterfeiter who was literally making millions. It all started when a man named John Vogel sent a package to his business address in Minnesota.
Hey, what are you shipping today?
What do you mean?
What's inside the box?
What? Well, what did I put on down on the form?
You wrote down clothes.
Yeah, that's right. Clothes.
And it's going to Minnesota?
Yeah.
The clerk was suspicious with Vogel's answers to the questions. Being that it's on a border town and being cognizant drugs do originate out of Mexico into the United States, she contacted U.S. Customs officials.
There you go.
Customs officials arrange for a drug sniffing dog to come in. Dog alerted or hit on the package for the presence of narcotics. Customs officials then arrange for the package to be forwarded on to Minnesota.
Let's see what we got here.
Local police and customs agents were waiting for the parcel when it arrived in Minnesota. A search warrant allowed them to inspect the contents.
I was a betting man.
Inside the package, they found various pieces of men's clothing and also two aerosol containers with fake bottoms.
Bingo.
Inside the containers were about 4 grams of cocaine and 38 $100 bills. And several strips of test print that shows a counterfeit that reflects a treasury seal and serial numbers.
A 4 gram cocaine bust is not even a pistol shot in the war on drugs.
This is bogus.
But authorities have stumbled upon what would prove to be one of the biggest counterfeit operations on record. Investigators quickly traced the identity of the man who had sent the package. His name was John Bryson Vogel, and he was no stranger to the law. Vogel had served time for armed bank robbery, captured only after a violent high-speed chase. Since his parole in 1991, he had operated a small printing business just outside Minneapolis, Minnesota. Federal investigators put Vogel's cocaine and counterfeit bills back inside his package. Then the parcel was taken to Vogel's business, special delivery, courtesy of an undercover Secret Service agent. Moments after the delivery, Vogel had unexpected visitors.
You John Vogel?
Yeah.
Federal agents. They have a search warrant to search your premises.
Got the package.
Mr. Vogel, you're under arrest.
Officials found approximately $50,000 in counterfeit money. Some of the counterfeit looked like it had just recently been printed. It was drying open on the various workbenches in his shop. Vogel's counterfeit was described as very good or excellent. He used various colors of ink on the bills, as well as some of the colored threads that are put into the bills for authenticity. Officials also searched a storage locker Vogel had rented. In that locker, they found 196,114 counterfeit $100 bills.
Holy Moses.
John Vogel was indeed a self-made millionaire. The bogus C-notes added up to an eye-popping $19,611,000, the fourth largest haul in United States history. Vogel had been printing the bills since shortly after his release from prison.
Vogel had served time for a 1986 armed bank robbery. While he was incarcerated, he was assigned to the printing industry. There, it's believed he learned the counterfeiting trade from another inmate.
Authorities nabbed Vogel just in time. Though he had pressed millions in phony bills, he had circulated less than $50,000 worth. Authorities learned that Vogel had logged thousands of miles, crisscrossing America, and spending his phony $100 bills one by one. By the time he was arrested, Vogel's handiwork had surfaced at nearly half the states in the country. On January 17, 1995, Vogel was released on a personal recognizance bond. He promptly disappeared and has not been seen since. Next, the strange case of Justin Burgwinkle. Did he run away from the army, or did a secret operation lead to his death? Justin Burgwinkle, Specialist, United States Army. He reported for duty in the summer of 1990. In the summer of 1993, he went AWOL, absent without leave, and inexplicably disappeared. 3 months later, Justin's car was found, gathering dust in the parking lot of a remote Northern California motel. The discovery proved to be one more indecipherable clue, one more dead end that left Justin's family anxiously waiting and wondering.
And I don't know if he ran away from the army. I don't know if he was kidnapped. I don't know if he was murdered. I do not have one clue what happened to him.
Specialist Justin Burgwinkle was respected by his superiors, well-liked by his fellow soldiers, and by all accounts simply not the type to suddenly go AWOL. However, on several occasions, Justin himself hinted at a secret life of undercover operations. At the time, it seemed as if he was staging cloak-and-dagger theatrics to impress his friends. But today, those closest to Justin believe the key to his disappearance may lie somewhere in a shadowy world of intrigue and deception. When he enlisted, Justin Burgwinkle set his sights on an elite combat unit known as the Rangers. He scored high on Army tests and began language training in Korean. However, within 6 months, Justin was yanked from the prestigious program after he was implicated in a shoplifting incident.
Go down there when I was back in language school.
Ultimately, Justin was transferred to Fort Ord near Monterey, California. There, the would-be language specialist found himself assigned to kitchen duty, serving up meals to some 1,000 soldiers.
That's the next hotspot. They're going to have nuclear weapons.
He had wanted to go in and be a ranger, and of course, part of being a ranger is going through the language school. When they took him out of there and put him in the cook section, He really had a hard time dealing with that at first, but then he kind of refocused himself and said, well, you know, if I want to be a ranger, I'm going to have to get back in there and really soldier to get back there.
Like many of his fellow soldiers, Justin frequented area nightclubs on the weekend. In August of 1992, he met Yolanda Antunes, a computer science student at Santa Clara University.
Where do you want to go?
I know a good 24-hour place down the street.
Okay. There was a rapport there, and he asked me for my phone number, and I gave it to him. And then one weekend, he showed up at my door, picked me up. We went to San Francisco, and that's when it started. We spent a whole day in San Francisco, and we knew, you know. I knew that he was a great guy.
Yolanda lived here in Santa Clara, south of San Francisco. Fort Ord was 85 miles down the coast near Monterey. Before long, Justin was visiting Yolanda at every opportunity. During the subsequent months, she began to see the first signs of Justin's secretive life. Citing urgent business, he would interrupt his stay to shuttle back and forth between Yolanda's apartment and Monterey.
All of a sudden, he'll just stop what he's doing with me in the afternoon, and he'll just say, I'm sorry, but I have to go up to Monterey and see some people, but I'll be right back. And I'll be just saying, just like that, out of the blue. And he said, just don't ask me what it's about, I'll just return. And that started kind of bothering me because we would have a good day, and all of a sudden he'll leave. And then he started getting more vague. I can't tell you. I really can't discuss this with you right now. It's not right for you to know. And later on, it became more like, it just won't be a good thing for you to know. It won't be, you know, I'm doing something, you know, kind of secret, and I can't reveal it to you.
In February of 1993, Justin was transferred from Fort Ord to Fort Lewis near Tacoma, Washington. It wasn't until May, some 10 weeks later, that Justin made the trip south to spend a two-week furlough with Yolanda. She recalls the visit as a jumble of baffling incidents and odd behavior.
Justin always had a briefcase with him, but I didn't think much of it because a briefcase is a briefcase. You can't make much about a briefcase, except he would be very secretive about it. He would never open it in front of me.
Can you stay turned around?
Don't you want me to leave the room?
No, just please stay turned around.
That was this one time, and I kind of angled myself just to turn and look over my shoulder to see what he was doing. All he's doing with that briefcase is taking pieces of paper out and shredding them with his hands, just tearing them into little tiny, tiny pieces. I mean, to little squares this small.
Whatever Justin was involved in seemed to be veering out of control. Yolanda says that one day she found Justin alone in the living room, sobbing.
Justin?
Oh.
Justin, what's wrong?
Nothing.
You okay?
No, yeah, I'm fine.
Justin never clarified the incident, and it was soon eclipsed by a more mysterious episode. It happened on a night when Justin was out with friends.
Hello?
Kurt Winkle there.
Justin? No, he's not. Who's this?
Don't worry about it. Can you give him a message?
Okay.
The mission's off.
What?
Just tell him. The mission's off.
The mission's off.
That's right.
Justin came back. I woke up because I heard him. And he looked completely pale, completely frightened.
Hi, Justin. Justin, you had a phone call tonight.
Here?
Yeah, some guy called and said that the mission's off. What mission?
Damn it! Damn it! Oh.
Justin?
What time did they call?
I think it was around 9:30.
Who was it? What'd they say the name was?
They didn't give a name. They just said, tell him that the mission's off, and they just hung up.
Damn it! Damn it!
Justin, who are they? Who are these people?
Justin refused to discuss the call or explain the message.
Justin!
Yolanda was still in the dark a few days later when Justin packed his bags and headed back to Fort Lewis.
I'm gonna go down and see her next weekend. I'm gonna drive down.
During his first week back at the base, Justin called his parents and sounded perfectly normal and upbeat.
No, really, I'm doing good. How about you guys?
However, at around the same time, for reasons that remain obscure, Justin purchased two handguns and more than 100 rounds of ammunition. Friday, June 4th, 1993, 0430 hours. Private Justin Bergwinkel failed to report for kitchen duty at Fort Lewis.
The dining facility should have reported him as being absent Friday when he didn't show up. Because he was a good soldier, he'd never been in trouble before that. They kind of tried to protect him and say, well, we'll find out where he is and deal with it ourselves instead of turning him in.
Have I seen Bergwinkel?
Monday morning, they realized that they couldn't protect him any longer because it had been a long time, and they suspected that, you know, something out of the ordinary was going on.
Yeah, Captain Heinzelman, now this is the duty sergeant in the mess hall. Got an AWOL, sir. It looks like...
For a man who had apparently gone AWOL, Justin was not making much of an effort to hide. In fact, he had been at Yolanda's since late Friday night.
What are you doing here?
Well, I came to see you.
What time is it?
It's about 3. Aren't you glad to see me?
It's 3 o'clock in the morning. So I don't know how he could get more time off, but I thought, well, if he was able to, that's really great, and I did want to see him.
Yolanda soon learned that Justin was not exactly on vacation. She insisted that he call his parents.
No, I'm not AWOL. I wouldn't do anything like that. No, I'm going to call Heinzelman. That's a mistake. I'm going to figure that out. I'm working. Yes, I'm working.
And I said, well, what do you mean you're working? And he just said, I can't tell you anymore. He said, but I will straighten it out.
I'll have to explain it all later, and I will, okay? I just can't. I'm doing something very important right now, all right? You've got to believe me, and I'll explain it to you later.
I said to him, at least call Captain Heinzelman, you know, at least call him. And he said that he would.
Justin did call into the unit. He did indicate that he was going to come back and that he had a couple more things to do. Once he got them taken care of, that he was going to come back to the unit and report back in.
But Justin did not report in. Instead, he remained at Yolanda's and continued his mysterious trips to Monterey.
What's going on? Let me help you.
There's nothing you can do to help me,
then
okay?
Let me go with you.
Don't make me do this right
Justin,
now.
Justin, please.
No, look, I have to go, okay?
Justin!
All right.
What are you getting yourself into?
You know the movie, White Sands? Watch that movie, okay?
In a conversation with his parents, Justin had made the same cryptic reference to the film White Sands. Released in 1992, the movie plunges its viewers and its briefcase-toting hero into the duplicitous world of international arms smuggling.
It's about gun running, the FBI and the CIA, and this one's against this one, and you don't know who the good guy is, and you don't know who the bad guy is, and...
You know, then I thought, are you working for the CIA? You know, it was all too confusing, but that's the only clue, if anything, that he's ever given me about it.
See you later.
Saturday, June 12th. Justin left Yolanda's apartment at around 10 a.m., once again headed for Monterey. But this time, Justin Bergwinkel would not come back.
Next couple of months, I was on the phone with the Army, my senators, you know, anyone I could think of to call to try to get the Army to do something. I couldn't get anybody to help me. The police wouldn't go to the girlfriend's house. I mean, nobody would do anything. Nobody ever looked for him, ever.
The windswept outskirts of Monterey yielded one final clue in this puzzling case. 3 months after Justin vanished, his car was found in the parking lot of an isolated beachfront motel. The Bergwinkels flew in from Massachusetts to investigate. They learned that their son's name did not appear in the motel register, although the car had been in the parking lot for nearly 3 months.
This briefcase.
The manager assumed it had been left by a guest for later pickup. Justin's handguns were nowhere to be found, but his briefcase had been stashed in the trunk. Curiously, his car keys were locked inside, along with his wallet, credit cards, and military ID.
You knew something was drastically wrong. And you knew, like, more or less, that he had placed everything just the way he wanted it found. That's the way I looked at it.
Tucked in Justin's wallet was a standard-issue military dog tag. When Yolanda learned of that discovery, she recalled a chilling conversation.
We were driving down one time in his car, and Justin had his dog tags, and he said, "Do you know what they're for?" I kind of had an idea, but I just said, no, what are they for? And he says, "Well, when a soldier dies, they put in his teeth so you can identify him." I said, "Okay." He says, "Well, if you ever see these, you know, lying around, you know, that means I'm dead."
Is Justin Bergwinkle dead, swallowed up by a murky secret life? Or did he simply run away and cover his disappearance with an elaborate fantasy plucked from a Hollywood movie?
I really don't think it's possible that he ran away. The three things he loves, he loved his mother, he loved his girlfriend deeply, and he loved his car. And in that day, he just threw everything away. Everything was gone. I just can't believe anybody could do that without any trace or anything.
Justin was not the type of person that would go AWOL. Very reliable, dependable. You could always count on him to get the job done. So him going AWOL surprised everybody that I knew. It just didn't happen with him.
I like to believe he's still alive. I don't like to think he's dead, but if he was, I wish I could find out, and then I could at least bury him and put it to rest, because the not knowing, that's about the worst thing that I can imagine, is not knowing what happened to him.
In a moment, murder invades a small town when an unknown hitchhiker turns violent. It was around midnight, June 22nd, 1991, in Harrington, Delaware.
Coffee, black.
A factory worker named Charles Holden stopped by a fast food restaurant at the end of his shift. It was a typical night for Charles, until he left the restaurant.
I went in and got my hamburger, and I was all the way across the lot and got in my truck, started my truck, and as I proceed to get ready to back up, I noticed there was a man right at my passenger window.
"Hey, man, I wonder if I could get a ride."
"Well, I don't know, it's pretty late."
"Hey, but I'm like in a big time bind, man. My sister, she's had a baby. She's up in Georgetown. I gotta get there."
I live pretty close by.
In the end, Charles relented. Harrington was a small town, mostly friendly.
All right.
Charles assumed he had nothing to worry about. 3 miles down Highway 14, Charles reached the intersection where he normally turned to go home.
Yeah, I pulled off to the side, and I said, "This is as far as we go, right here."
"I guess this is where you have to get off."
"Hey, man, I gotta get down the road. I ain't getting out of this truck."
"Well, I can't go any further. I told you I could just go a few miles, you know."
"Listen, I got a problem, and I ain't getting out of this truck."
"Well, I can't help you. I can't. You're gonna have to leave. I'm sorry."
"No, then I'm gonna have to take this truck."
Without warning, the stranger attacked. Charles grabbed his keys and jumped from the truck.
He come after me with a knife or a screwdriver.
"What you looking in there for? Ain't nobody gonna help you. Now, this all been taken care of. I'm gonna kill you.
All right.
I'm gonna kill you right here.
All right, just calm down.
I want that truck."
All right, I'll take you wherever you want to go, man. Just calm down, all right?
"I ain't playing with you. I want that truck.
Come on, we'll go. I'll take you over. Come on."
Charles knew he had to act fast. As he and the assailant headed back to the truck, Charles made his move. Charles sped off in the opposite direction of his house so the man could not follow him home.
Went down the road a little ways, turned around. I didn't see him nowhere in sight. Went down the other way. I turned around. Didn't see him nowhere in sight. So I finished down the road. And when I come back to my driveway, he was at my trailer.
Somehow, by some disturbing coincidence, the stranger had found his way to Charles's trailer. Now Charles had an additional concern. His trailer was adjacent to a small farmhouse where his 70-year-old mother lived. Charles rushed to a payphone and called the police.
How you doing? I'm Trooper Williams with the Delaware State Police. Are you Mr. Holden?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Holden just explained to me that he had been home by his residence and saw this black male there, and that he needed somebody to go back with him because this person was hanging around his mom's residence and his residence. Once we got there, we checked to see if the doors were locked and everything, and both the back and front door of his trailer were locked.
Well, Mr. Holden, it looks like your house is secure here.
All right. Could you come take a look at my mom's house?
And we walked across the grass, because their property is adjacent to each other. We walked across the grass and around to the back door of the residence. And that's when the two of us discovered that the back window to the back door was broken.
Mom?
I thought something wrong when I first hollered. Because Mom, she was the type of mother that she would be awake until I got in at night. Then she'd go to sleep.
Mom?
In an upstairs bedroom, Charles Holden found the body of his mother, Dorothy Donovan. Dorothy had been stabbed repeatedly in the chest, arms, and face. The police found nothing missing from Dorothy's house and ruled out robbery as a motive. When investigators heard Charles's story, their first instinct was that he had concocted an elaborate alibi.
I just drove around. I was scared. Okay, Charles, you're gonna need to come down and troop with us. We're gonna have to talk about this a little further, okay?
Just the mere coincidence of what he said happened. It's difficult for the investigators to believe that he picks this guy up, takes him a couple miles, drops him off, and next thing you know, he's at his mom's house, never having met this lady or Charles before, killing Dorothy Donovan. It just was very hard to believe, and it wasn't until we were able to go back and interview the people at the fast food restaurant were we able to, you know, see that, yes, this blackmail did exist.
If I could ask you ladies to do me like a really big favor, I'm trying to get up to Georgetown.
Also, later that day, we were able to obtain certain physical evidence at the scene, that being a bloody palm print. And we also have found two sources of DNA inside the residence. Neither of this physical evidence comes back to Charles Holden. So therefore, because of these things, we were able to eliminate Charles as a suspect.
The whole story seemed like a big nightmare to me. You know, it's just like you're in some kind of a dream. You don't think it really happened. You think you could drive over to my mother's house and she'd be there, you know, but I know that's not gonna be happening.
She meant the world to me. She called me every morning and never even say goodnight to us. Best friend I ever had. I miss that dearly.
If she had been killed in an automobile wreck or had a medical problem, I could accept that. And I don't think anybody has a right to kill someone and to take their life away like that.
Join me next Friday for another edition of Unsolved Mysteries.
Thank you.